I am Plato on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. A fascinating, important book out now from McClelland and Stewart is The Authenticity Hoax, How We Get Lost Finding Ourselves. It investigates authenticity, what it is, why we seek it, and what happens in the quest for it. What the author Andrew Potter finds is most interesting. It seems this demand for authenticity, ubiquitous as it is in our morality, politics, and social and consuming behavior, it is that we are in fact more artificial, more competitive, and self-absorbed, thus eroding our communities and our genuine relationships. What I liked about the book is that the author who joins me now weaves together his arguments using intellectual examples from philosophy and attach them to Oprah, Obama, and other popular cultural references that I can grasp. Andrew Potter is a columnist at Maclean's and an editor at Canadian Business and the co-author of the big bestseller, The Rebel Cell. He holds a PhD in philosophy and has taught at Trent University, the University of Toronto, and the University of Quebec at Montreal. The website for more is authenticityhoax.squarespace.com. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Andrew Potter. Good morning, Mr. Potter.
Hey, good morning.
I guess it's Dr. Potter, right?
Well, I don't really go by that anymore. I never really did, but it's been a long time since I've been in the biz, as they say. So yeah. It's just Andrew's fine.
This is a great book.
Thank you.
If we don't know what you're talking about, if we see the two ducks on the front cover at the bookstore, mm-hmm. how do you define authenticity?
That's the big question, because authenticity is one of those words like community or family that people only ever use as a term of praise or approbation. Like when you say that's authentic, everyone sort of knows you mean something. You mean it's good in some way, but it's not really sure what we mean. And so what I try and do in the first few chapters of the book, anyway, is ask the question: right, okay, we want authenticity, but authenticity as opposed to what? And so I spend the first few chapters unpacking that and trying to sort of get clear on what I call the jargon of authenticity, what we're talking about when we talk about the authentic.
But there are people who do define it, right? I mean, I'm sure marketers or religious people or Oprah, they define authentic some way. What's the most common way that they do?
Yeah, well, very often people sort of use it as a synonym for real or a synonym for sincere or other sort of just words that mean the same thing. And I think when you look at what they mean, it becomes pretty clear that when you talk about the authentic, you mean something, either a good or a service or an experience or a work of art or something that has characteristics that are in many ways either in opposition to or shying away from or criticizing the main sort of aspects of the modern world that we find really unpleasant. So the authentic tends to be anything that is in some way against the market economy, secularism, the march of technology, and sort of the main sort of elements of the mass liberal state. And so the authentic is sort of a refuge from the disquiet we feel about living in the modern world.
It's like the word transparent. Mm-hmm. I mean, in government, that's a good thing.
Right.
But I mean, if I called you that, that'd probably not be a compliment, right?
Right. Yeah. It's funny, but we're like transparent. Transparent is one of those words, like, it's almost like cleave. You know, cleave can either mean cut in half or stick to.
Yeah.
And transparent is one of those words that can either mean I can see you as you actually are, or I can see you right through you because there's nothing to you, right?
Yeah.
And that's funny because the idea of being transparent to the world is sort of the essence of often the authentic self as it's sort of explored through people like Rousseau and so on, this idea that who you are on the inside, you shouldn't wear a mask in society. You should always be utterly transparent to the world. There should be this accord between how you seem and how you actually are, which is sort of one of the longest standing aspects of the authentic quest.
And looking back through history, are we at a point where the authentic is sought more? Or sought the most, I should say?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's sort of a natural consequence of a number of things. One is it's a natural consequence of just the world sort of becoming faster and more technological and more dominated by markets. And so we and because the world or modernity is not unequivocally great. You know, it does have its downside. The more modern we become in this sense, the more we sort of seek refuge from it. Also, we become a bit richer. And sort of what I argue, one of the claims I make in the book, is that the search for the authentic is, to a certain extent, a form of status-seeking. As we become wealthier, we can afford to sort of pursue the authentic in all kinds of ways that we couldn't before. It becomes much more of a mass accessible product.
And that's one of the great points of the book, is that it's exclusionary. Mm-hmm. And I think you make this a point in the book that if you and I are talking about where we're going for vacation, if you go to the more obscure place, mm-hmm. or the more authentic place, if you will, mm-hmm. that sort of excludes everyone else, right?
Right.
Who's to blame for this?
I think no one's really to blame. I mean, if you want to blame anyone, you sort of blame, you can do the same thing that Rousseau did and just blame civilization, which is that the nature of being in society means that we all kind of want things that individually we can maybe achieve, but collectively we can't. When it comes to pursuing things like the authentic, in a lot of ways, it's one big collective action problem that we're in here, where we end up pursuing things that are collectively self-defeating in a lot of ways. So I think it's sort of a good question and an important point to make, which is that even though I sort of criticize the search for the authentic as being a disguised form of status-seeking, I don't necessarily want to impugn the motives of the people who look for the authentic and say, oh, all they're trying to do is one-up their neighbors or one-up their coworkers. They're not. They're looking for something that actually is worth having, but it's just not everyone can have it. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Because people do think of the authentic, the getting of the authentic is a sort of cure for consumerism and the sort, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And because when we think about consumerism, especially conspicuous consumption or conspicuous displays, you think of people who buy fancy cars or people who buy big houses, and you think, oh, they're just showing off how rich they are and how much taste they have. And I think that one thing that gets neglected is, and so what's happened for people who don't want to be seen as consumers, what they want to do now is show that they might have a big house, they might have a car, but they don't want to sort of show that they're connected to any of it in any spiritual sense. What they really want is an experience or a lifestyle or a set of relationships that speaks to their deepest personal values. And often that'll mean something like going on a voluntourism trip where you go to Nepal and help out at a medical station, or you go and do ecotourism, or you know, any of the number of examples I give in the book. And I think what we forget is that has the same competitive and contrastive dynamic as good old-fashioned conspicuous consumption. I call it conspicuous authenticity.
Now, you talk in the book about Obama, and, mm-hmm. and I think that's an interesting way to look at this and his relationship to authenticity, because his election meant a lot of things, mm-hmm. and how does that relate to the people's quest for authenticity?
Yeah, Obama was a really interesting character on this, because there were two. I think the American election in general was very interesting. I mean, you might recall, like, it basically boiled down to a fight between competing conceptions of like who's more authentic, John McCain, the maverick, and Sarah Palin, the sort of the crazy maverick, right? Yeah. And Barack Obama with his postpartisan and authentically black personality. And with Obama, there were two interesting aspects. One was, because you might remember during the primaries, when it looked like he wasn't going to win, that the black community in the United States went after him for not being authentically black. Mm-hmm. And this was like seen, like people like Jesse Jackson and so on were criticizing him for not being black enough. And the main criticism there was that his father was from Eastern Africa, whereas true, that is, authentic American blacks are supposed to be descended from slaves who came from the curve of Western Africa. But once he won, that became sort of a side issue. People sort of dropped that. And what became more interesting for Obama was this idea that he was going to do away with one of the main things people say they don't like about politics, which is the partisanship. And he was going to broker this post-partisan consensus, a new sort of form of politics that wouldn't break down along party lines or ideological lines. It would be all about consensus and dialogue, all these so-called things that we see as the essence of authenticity. And it really hasn't worked out that way, unfortunately.
And then we take authenticity to another angle of politics and political life. And you talk in the book that it is that authenticity is a culprit behind, and I've got it written here, behind a debased political structure dominated by negative advertising and character assassination.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, I do. So is that a direct quote?
Yeah.
What that's about is if you ask people, you know, what they think about contemporary politics, many of them will tell you that they don't like it, and they'll list a number of things they don't like, one of which is, I mentioned, the partisanship. But they also don't like the fact that it's very personal. There's a lot of character assassination. It's focused on leadership and their personalities, and it gets us into attack ads and negative campaigning and all this sort of really nasty stuff. And what they say they want is more authenticity in our politics. But I actually think that's dangerous. I mean, authenticity is causing the problem. And the reason is that if you make whether someone is authentic or not as a leader part of their political the requirement to be an adequate leader, you make their character a matter of political importance. And once their character is a matter of political importance, then it's basically open season, right? You make attack ads and character assassination almost required for the opposition. And so this quest for the authentic ends up being in a lot of ways causing the very problems that we have with politics, which is it's very personal and attack ad driven.
And in Canada, we saw a bit of this with Stephen Harper. Mm-hmm. Like when he first came on the scene, people were making fun of his haircut, that he had man boobs and the sort.
Yeah.
but to a lot of people, he seemed authentic almost.
Yeah, well, the thing with Stephen Harper is he's a really interesting case, right? Because one of the things I argue, is that we say we want authenticity. We want somebody to be spontaneous and natural. And then Stephen Harper famously showed up, you know, in a bad shirt looking like he was not very fit around the chest area and got slaughtered for it in the satirical press, right? And then he went and hired an image consultant. Everyone's like, oh, what are you doing hiring an image consultant, you big phony? And so, you know, we can't make up our minds as the public what we want. But what I think Stephen Harper has done is actually managed to, and this is I'm going to say, construct an authentic identity, right, which sounds like an oxymoron, but as they say in advertising, in politics, authenticity is the hardest thing to fake. If you can fake that, you've got it made. And I think he started to figure out a way of doing it. I mean, because his brand is built around this sort of Tim Hortons-y, folksy, hockey dad kind of thing, he's able to sort of put on a sweater vest and, you know, play a Beatles tune at an NEC gala in Ottawa with Yo-Yo Ma in a way that makes it seem extremely middle brow. And that kind of stuff is actually, you know, increasingly, I mean, no one's ever going to warm to Stephen Harper, but he does come across, I think, increasingly as a guy who has less of a hidden agenda than people assume. I think he's coming across as a lot more transparent. You know, I have friends in the Ottawa press gallery who say that, you know, no one ever believes Stephen Harper when he says things, but increasingly they're starting to realize that he actually says what he thinks more often than people give him credit for.
Yeah.
Which is rare for a politician.
Right, right. Now, how do we get away, in general now, from the cycle of authenticity?
How do we get away? Well,
do we get away at all?
Not entirely. I think because for two reasons. First of all, I think it's important to sort of keep in mind, and this is something I don't make as clear in the book as I probably should have. If I could go back and rewrite the conclusion, I might, which is that the search to be authentic, even though I'm sort of saying it's sort of in a lot of ways an anti-modern thrust, it is part and parcel with the birth of modernity. So Rousseau is as much an Enlightenment thinker as Voltaire, for instance. And so what I would say is that the quest for the authentic is in a lot of ways part of the self-critical dynamic of Western thought. It's part of what makes us so robust as a civilization, is the idea that, you know, we don't let our technology and our quest for progress run away completely. We have these sort of authenticity seekers sort of calling us on it and saying, well, what about the past and what about the slow and so on. And I think that's valuable. But what I do think is that the authenticity does cause problems, and also it does get us into this hamster wheel of competitive or conspicuous authenticity. And the solution there, I think, is to a certain extent you just need to choose your spots. There's this great book written by an economist named Robert Frank called Picking the Right Pond, or Choosing the Right Pond. And one of the arguments he makes is that life is one big set of competitions, including the quest for authenticity. And you just need to sort of pick the spots that matter to you and not worry about the competitions that don't, and sort of try and settle into a niche that you can succeed at and be happy with, and sort of let the rest of them fall where they may.
I'm trying to understand this idea that authenticity means no progress. I mean, does that mean, does that just really go back to the fact that we're trying to be like we once were? Is that where that no quest for no progress, I mean, the no progress comes from?
I sort of accuse it of that. Yeah, I accuse some authenticity seekers of sort of hiding behind, or at least having a sort of hidden agenda of their own, which is trying to hold back or being opposed to science and technology and sort of the treats of the modern world. Because I think it's important to keep in mind that modernity has a lot of problems, but. And we did leave a lot of things behind when we sort of became modern. We lost sort of the connection to the earth and the social relations and the family relations that seemed more authentic. But we gained a lot. We gained a tremendous amount. And I think we shouldn't sort of hide away in a nostalgia for the way things were. We should sort of accept that we made some trade-offs and that ultimately those trade-offs are probably worth making.
And I'm going to mispronounce this, I'm sure. Diogenes of Sinope?
Diogenes, yeah.
Diogenes, yeah. Mm-hmm. What do we learn from him?
Diogenes, the first cynic. Well, Diogenes is an interesting character because he's considered the first. He was a cynic philosopher, a Greek philosopher, and considered the first cosmopolitan. He said, "I'm a citizen of no state. I'm a citizen of the world." That's the literal meaning of cosmopolitan. And he, in a sense, was the one guy who, or one of the few people in history who has completely disengaged from all competitions, all status hierarchies, all searches for any sort of status or position in the world. And ultimately, that might be the authentic ideal, except you realize then that if that's what it means to be authentic, you know, who really wants to be that way? Because he was kind of a beggar. He lived in the streets. He was crude. And, you know, basically he was a homeless person of ancient Greece. And so I think he's almost a warning sign to say, like, is this really what we're thinking of when we think of the authentic? Because if it's not, then we might need to do a fundamental rethink of what we're actually looking for.
A lot of people view you as a contrarian.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think of yourself that way?
I guess. I mean, it's not something I set out deliberately to do. Part of being a philosopher by training is that you're trained to sort of look at arguments and take them apart, and look at the assumptions or the biases that are built into the positions people sort of make in the world. And it just sort of, and also being a columnist, which I've been for about 6 or 7 years now, columnists are basically complainers by trade. We're sort of professional complainers, and all of that does contribute to a contrarian state of mind, where when everyone agrees on something, you end up suspicious that you know maybe everybody's wrong, right? So yeah, I suppose I am a contrarian, which not a bad thing to be, I guess.
And how do you see yourself as in this role of the philosopher? Like, do you write this book merely to opine or to observe, mm-hmm. or do you write it in the hopes that we change ourselves?
I think you always hope that somebody will read it and sort of think. I mean, the best is when someone comes up and says, "I read your book, and you know, it changed the way I thought about the world." And Joe Heath and I in the Rebel Cell had, you know, some really gratifying discussions after that. People saying, "Look, I really changed the way I thought about consumerism and counterculture." And so, yeah, you want to change people's minds. You don't want to just be entertainment. I think any thinker doesn't want to just sort of say, you know, make neat observations. You want people to change the way they think about the world. Absolutely.
Yeah, and you're an editor at Canadian Business.
Yeah, I've been here for 6 weeks. Until recently, I was an editor at the Ottawa Citizen, and I've just been down in Toronto at Canadian Business, working under the. It's nice because it's under the same corporate overview as Maclean, so I'm sort of in the same corporate womb now, which is very very nice.
And are you remaking, you and Steve Mache and Leanne George? Are you remaking that magazine almost? Or?
Yeah, well, I came in. They did a relaunch and a redesign last year, and yeah, Steve and Leanne came over from Maclean's, and I've been doing, I think, a really good job. And Ken White, the Maclean's editor, is now also the publisher of Canadian Business. And yeah, they offered to bring me on board to help have some fun with some business, and it's been fun so far.
Did you have fun writing this book?
At times, yeah, it took a lot longer than it should have. I wrote it in fits and starts. I started the book actually about 3.5 years ago, and wrote about half of it, and then took a long break when I became a newspaper editor, and then got back into it about a year ago. And yeah, it's fun in fits and starts. I find writing very difficult. I know some people can just sort of dash off 1,000 words before breakfast and I'm not one of those people, so which is why I'm not going to write 20 books in my life. I might write 4 or 5 if I'm lucky.
Yeah. What I like about the book is that it's lively, and it you have to sort of read it. The way, I don't know how to explain this, but I like books like where you can read it and it seems like you're talking fast.
Right.
And it just seems that way. And that's what I really enjoyed about it. Congratulations on the book, Andrew. I've enjoyed the conversation today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The website for more is authenticityhoax.squarespace.com. The book is called The Authenticity Hoax, How We Get Lost Finding Ourselves. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. It's author Andrew Potter on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunto.